Accession number 12502, Reel 4.
Marshal Lord Bramwell, Reel 4. I think you were saying that you had a tremendous feeling of pride when you collected your half-tracks.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it was a completely new thing for an infantryman to have this medal. And we felt that you know, we were really in business.
When you were moving in these vehicles along a road, what sort of speed would you generally go at?
On a road?
Yes, road movement.
Well, I would have thought, you know, they were quite heavy. Heavy, big vehicles. I would have thought you were going about 25 to 30 miles an hour, that sort of thing. Really, you didn't go much more than that.
Cross country?
20, 25.
It was about the same.
Well, 25 to 30, we'll get a bit more on the road. But it depended on the going. Of course, if you came to ditches and things, or but tracks, you could go about 20, 25 miles an hour. Might do a bit more, but you had a lot of weight on, you see, carrying all your kit. And
how did the unit get resupplied with fuel? Was that brought up to you by your echelons?
Absolutely. The echelons came out, it was before the days of big Bowsers and things like that, so they'd it was all done by jerry cans. Jerry can being another war-winning factor like the DC-3 and the Jeep and so on. They were all done by jerry cans. The tanks would harbour or leaguer, or they would be in a farmyard or whatever it may be, and these the echelon would bring it up. The A1 echelon would bring up the jerry cans on a three-tonner. Take any empty ones off them and give them full ones, and they'd fill up from there.
When you were going out on operations, or you were going to be committed to a major action, how were you actually informed of what was going to happen? Did you have a sort of battalion conference where there was a general briefing, or was it done through the company network?
Well, all the time I've been talking about so far, and we started to change, really, when we went after Falaise, but all the times up to then, we'd been a company in an armoured regiment, and the company commander got his orders either over the air, in which case he passed them on to us from the armoured regiment, because they were used to giving and taking orders, or there was an O group, and he went to that and said what they wanted to do. And probably the company was held as a company, moving with behind the leading squadron or with battalion headquarters. But it might well be, and I knew occasions of this, where the leading squadron was given a platoon. And once, I do remember very well, hurtling across country behind a squadron of the CLY, commanded by a chap who later became editor or sub-editor of the Times, called Olive Woods, and overrunning German field artillery positions and having to, you know, look after the tanks, take the prisoners, collect the prisoners and so on, and generally act as a sort of dog's body for the armour. But we were moving them with the armour. So that did happen occasionally. And then a little later on, there was a tendency to group the motor battalion with one of the armoured regiments rather than put company to company. And then you had what became the makings of the present-day square brigade, really.
Were most orders given verbally, or did you have a lot of written orders?
Very few written orders. Very few written orders. I'm just wondering, think if we had a written order for... No, they were virtually all given either verbally or over the radio using various codes or through O groups where the commander went to hear what he had to do and came back with his map marked and so on.
Did you have regular or frequent visits from the brigade commander and from other senior officers?
We saw the brigade commander quite a lot. Yes, quite a lot. I saw Mike Carver quite a lot. He got to know us, all of us. When we were for a time in 11th Armoured Division, I remember seeing the divisional commander, and they tended to know who you were, which was very nice. I never saw Monty in the battle, I don't think, although I did go to his headquarters once to for a sort of prize giving. I saw the corps commander once, who was Ritchie. Yes, I mean, I think you did see him, bearing in mind what they had to do. I think one saw them really quite a considerable amount of time. I think they all appeared whenever they should do, to come and see us, find out what was happening.
If we can move on now then from Normandy, you went through the Falaise Gap area and then on to the Seine. Did you have any difficulty in crossing the River Seine?
No, the bridgehead had been established by a brigade, infantry brigade, and we went through and then took over the lead. And we then went up into the First World War battlefields. And I can spot all the places that we went on the ground. We went through a place called Saint-Paul. We went very near Armentières. We went very near Lille. We crossed the Belgian border, I think, just south of Lille, as far as I remember, right through the old coal mining area of the First World War. And indeed the battlefields of the First World War. We were quite near Bapaume, St. Paul. I mean, if we had a map, I could show you exactly the route we took, but that was generally, and we went into Belgium, near Mons, between Lille and Mons, somewhere there. And we were on more or less on the left flank. Well, the Canadians were actually going to come up on our left, the Canadian Corps, but they were a bit behindhand and dealing with the various ports like Le Havre and places like that. And we were cutting across to the Scheldt, with the 11th Armoured Division actually going into Antwerp, where, and it's understandable how it happened, they forgot that, of course, it was rather important to occupy the east bank of the Scheldt, which they never actually did. And so the Germans were able to get quite a lot of their army back across there. But we were holding the left end, and, of course, Germans coming from the Pas-de-Calais were bumping into us continually. And we had a number of engagements and...
Were these engagements serious and organised, or was it a case of German stragglers just trying to...
I don't think they were that organised, but of course, with the Germans, if you bump into them, they fight back.
You mentioned driving through German positions, I think, during this phase, driving along a road and there were Germans...
Yes, that was in North East France.
Yes. And what did those Germans do?
They didn't do anything. I mean, they were...
They were astonished.
They were astonished. And I mean, we had centre lines, we had objectives. It was, I think, a fairly good moon. They didn't have the anti-tank. The bigger anti-tank weapons couldn't really see to fire. They did have a certain number of bazookas. But the speed was such that they didn't have really any organised resistance, not until we got up into Belgium.
As though they were in the same condition that the French army were when the Germans were driving through northern France after crossing at Sedan in 1940, that they were paralysed by sheer surprise.
And you might say the Iraqis in the Gulf, too.
Yes, indeed.
Hmm. I mean, it does show what armour can do if it once gets moving. We didn't have any aids other than what they call movement light, which were searchlights bouncing off clouds, which gave us a certain amount of thing. But the terrific roar, you see, we didn't have any lights on the vehicles itself, and all the Germans heard was this huge roar of unlimited tanks and vehicles and so on. And very seldom, and if they had fought hard and blocked the road, you know, there would have been a problem. You'd had to then got round it and continue the advance. But it was happening on comparatively wide front. And there was a bit of a gap. You were really into the headquarters and echelons, the fighting troops that either been destroyed in Falaise
or
gone back to Germany or up in the part of Calais, which was on our flank. And there wasn't really very much between us and Brussels.
I think you mentioned that you took St. Nicolas, just outside Antwerp. Did you have to fight for it, or was it...
We didn't have to fight to get into it. And as we came into the middle of the square, the whole of the population turned out, and everybody was pouring over our vehicles and kissing everybody and so on, and suddenly, with a roar, the Germans opened up with artillery onto the middle of the square, which caused everybody to, all the civilians, disappear into their houses pretty quickly. And then we had to set up a defence line.
Well, was that line attacked, or were you able to...
Well, it was harassed, but it wasn't. They veered off, really, and went further north. But there was one case, and I can't remember where it is. I remember so much that my platoon was, I suppose, in this defence line, and our position was the back end of the village, covering a road out of the village, and if you're going to have a defence in a village, it is best to be in the back end where you have the advantage rather than the front end where you can get shot off it. So we were in a defence position. And we were covering this road. And suddenly I remember the runner waking me up and saying, Mr. Bramall, there's a whole German armoured division coming into the end of the village. So of course, we all stood too. And this thing came and... When it got to the village, it veered off to the side, so it didn't come straight through us at all. But we were protecting a particular line, and I think it went off further up towards the Scheldt. Our job was to stop it coming down into...
Did you have contact with the Canadians? Presumably they were on your immediate left.
I don't remember any contact with the Canadians at that time. Not at all. I remember the Canadians earlier in Normandy, but I don't remember them at that time.
What did you think of the Canadians when you saw them in Normandy?
Well, I think they were pretty tough chaps. Pretty good, really. I mean, I don't know about their commanders and so on, but I think they were very good soldiers. Tough soldiers.
Had you seen anything of the Americans?
Well, I hadn't, at that stage, come across the Americans. I did later on, when the line stabilised, and we were down in the sort of Viet-Roermond area, because we were 4th Armoured Brigade were on the right of the British line, and the 7th US Armoured Division, commanded by a chap called Sylvester, we all called him Victor Sylvester, was on the left of the Americans. And... Sylvester and Patton had terrible rows, I know, but this was the U.S. First Army, I suppose. Simpson, was it First Army? I think it was.
Was it Hodges?
Hodges, or it was it Hodges?
It had been Bradley in Normandy, hadn't it?
Yeah, then it was Hodges.
Then it was Hodges.
Right. So we were on there, and one stage, because we were bordering on it to keep it, I went on patrol with an American Armored Division patrol on this area, which we... In the course of the patrol, we went from Belgium, Holland, and Germany in this course of this patrol. It was right on the border. And I remember being particularly struck that there was someone in the American patrol who could speak fluently each one of the languages of the places we went into because of their background. But I hadn't, and it was difficult to say then. They were a bit sort of gung-ho, but I do think that the Americans... And I think their breakout from the Normandy bridgehead under Patton was a remarkable technical achievement, and probably under Patton they moved faster than anyone else would have done. And secondly, I do think they fought extremely well in the not everywhere, but in the middle of the breakthrough in the Ardennes, in places like Saint-Vincent-Bastogne, they did come into their own, although earlier on there had been a bit of panic, which Monty exploited, but I think there they did fight very well. I think they're quite quick learners, but they seem to take almost masochistic satisfaction of having hell knocked out of them in some ways. You know.
Certainly I think that there's evidence that when they were pushing their way forward to Saint-Lô through the Bocage in Normandy, each American division developed its own system of new tactics for coping with that sort of country. But I think the same thing happened in British divisions too, in the 50th Division in particular. They adapted all their battle drills to the new conditions.
Mm.
So after St. Nicholas, where did you go next? Did you spend
a long
time?
I think there was a place called Beverinvaus or something, which is all next door there. Then we went over.
Across the Scheldt.
No, we didn't cross the Scheldt. No, we well, the Scheldt was crossed lower down. Yes. We went to the right flank then, to a place called Wirt. And we were then put on the right flank, to begin with, of the attack that was going to be made up towards Arnhem. And we were on the banks of the Maas. And I spent my 21st birthday in a slit trench on the banks of the Maas in the winter 44-45, patrolling. We moved several times. We kept on moving from side to side. First of all, I remember we were on a canal line at Wirt. And
it was the Albert Canal.
Yeah, I think it would have been. I'd easier if I had a map. We were on a canal line. We did patrolling up to and over the canal. And we had one great success because we used to move forward from our main position to the canal. And at sort of first light in the morning. And after we'd been doing it about 3 days, I thought, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to do this again because they may have rumbled to this and they may come over the canal and lay an ambush for us. And so we went in much earlier than we'd done before by night, and we did actually shoot them up coming in to ambush us. So that was very, very lucky. And I think we killed two and the rest disappeared back over the canal.
How were they crossing? Were they in
small little... It wasn't very wide. They had little dinghies, little rubber boats.
Mm. How far back from the canal bank were your main positions?
Half a mile, that sort of thing, perhaps. About half a mile back.
And then the 30 Corps went up through
stage, we were on December. Wait a minute, we're now talking about September, of course, when they went up to Market Garden. And that's when we were on this canal on the right flank. And they then went up to Arnhem. And at some stage, we were moved across in October to the other flank towards Tilburg. And this is where we had some very interesting times. We were at a place on the frontier called Poppel, just over the border. We had did lots of patrolling in the woods, quite a lot of close action with the Germans. And this is where we eventually started to liberate these towns in southern Holland. And I was sent on a patrol to see if there were any Germans in a place called Geurle, G-O-R-L-E. Been a very unpleasant couple of weeks. I mean, we were very close to the Germans. There was a lot of mortar fire, shelling, patrolling and contact in the various woods. But there was a feeling that the Germans might have pulled back, and I was sent on patrol. So I went on up towards Geurle with my platoon, I came to the bridge over a little river, and it was all barricaded with everything across it. So I thought it might be booby-trapped, so I took my platoon into the ploughed field at the side, waded across the river, and into another ploughed field to head for the village, just parallel with the road. And I was actually in front. I hadn't sent a scout on. I was in front for some reason, I don't know why. And suddenly there was an explosion, and the man behind me, who subsequently said he was walking in my footprints, because we were worried about mines, there'd been a lot of mines there, went up on a shoe mine, and his leg was virtually off. So, I mean, it was so much off that I actually had to cut away the rest of it. I mean, it was not, nothing could have saved his leg. It was hanging on by a bit of skin. So we had to get this chap out of the minefield, get him back. And so I said to everybody, don't move, just stay down. And I and another chap got on our hands and knees, and we started to clear away through the ploughed field. Well, prodding and clearing with the hands, because they, you know, these things were these little wooden mines. In order to get him onto a path, which I saw, which led back onto the road, where I could got on my radio to call up a vehicle to come in. And so we made quite good progress, and I got onto this path, and it looked reasonably secure. So I stood up, and as I stood up, I heard the most frightful click, and I looked down, and my foot was actually on a mine, and the thing had gone down and hadn't blown up. I've never been so terrified in my life. I eventually sort of gave a great leap off, by which time I probably would have gone on to another one. Anyhow, we got this chap out, and he's fine, and I see him occasionally. We got him back, and I then continued my patrol with a little bit more care into the village, and it seemed to be completely empty. And presently I saw a Dutch civilian, and I said, you know, are the Germans here? And he said, no, I think they've gone. So I said, well, we better go. So I got on the back of his motorcycle, and I went right through the village on this motorcycle, found out there were no Germans, and called up the battalion, and they sent up a company to reinforce. And 40 years after that, the Dutch chief of staff discovered this little episode, and we had a reunion in this particular place, and I did the walk that I actually did through the village and into this town. And then we pressed on through there, the whole brigade pressed on, right out towards Breda, and we were very soon, I don't think we were the first people into Tilburg, I think 15 Scottish were, but I think we were in
Shortly afterwards,
or on the edge of it. So that was in October. And then December, we moved across again to the other flank, to Roermond and the Maas. And that was when I spent my 21st birthday, which was on the 18th of December. So the 4th Armoured Brigade was used on both flanks of the attack onto Arnhem.
It must have been rather different suddenly being in wide open flat country with lots of water.
Very waterlogged place. Very waterlogged canals, rivers, woods too, actually, woods, but different sorts of woods, sort of pine wood, really.
So more open than the dense woodland you'd been working through in Normandy.
And the danger mostly was mines. Very, very nasty. These shoe mines were just scattered everywhere. And the trouble was that if you walked up a track, they were so sighted that if the Germans opened up on you, the obvious thing to do was to jump into the ditch to avoid it, and that was usually full of mines. And they cut your foot off just about there.
Middle of the shin.
Hmm?
The middle of the shin.
Yeah. They broke the shin bone. And that was, you lost your foot. You didn't, I mean, otherwise you were all right. You just took the bottom part of your leg off. And we lost a lot of casualties like that.
Did you find that by the time you were pushing through towards Roermond, people were beginning to get very tired as a result of having been in action continuously.
Well, we were, and of course some of the worst was still to come, unfortunately, because by far the nastiest battle that I fought in was the Reichswald, which was much now. I mean, Normandy and the Reichswald were the two unpleasant places. I mean, the other bits were the... You got excitement, you got odd bits of danger, but if you weren't in Arnhem at the bridge or somewhere like that, it was not quite as intense. The Rhine crossing was over pretty quickly, and the rest of it was really... Well, there were nasty moments, but it was pretty straightless.
But is it right to say that you had been more or less continuously in action or
movement
since the 9th of June onwards without any...
Absolutely.
There'd been no rest, no leave?
No, there'd been no rest, no leave. I'm just trying to think. I did get 2 days in Brussels at some stage, and it must have been round about then when we had before the Reichswald battle, which started, what, in February, March? That was very unpleasant. Horrible place. And the Germans beginning to resist again fiercely because, of course, it was the Schlieffen Line.
It was their homeland.
And it was their homeland, and that was very unpleasant.
Did you get involved at all in the fighting in the Ardennes?
Personally, no. But what we did do was why we were in the... That's why we were in the Reichswald battle, because the 29th Armoured Brigade was the Armoured Brigade of 11th Armoured Division. And that had gone to have a refit, and it was pulled out of refit to go down and help establish the line of the Ardennes. And 4th Armoured Brigade was put into 11th Armoured Division. And so we fought the Reichswald battle under command of General Roberts in the 11th Armoured Division, together with, well, an array of divisions. 3rd British, of course, was certainly there. Canadians were certainly there. I think 43rd and 51st were there. A very high intensity of troops coming down through Goch and Clever, down with the Rhine on your left flank and the Maas on your right flank.
When you were put into the 11th Armoured Division, did you notice any distinctive features in the style of command that General Roberts adopted?
Well, I think he was a very fine commander, of course. Very fine. We all thought he was tremendous. I think he understood armour, which was not always the case with some of the infantry divisions that we'd been put in command of. But, I mean, having said that, his what he could do in the Reichswald was heavily subscribed because it wasn't really armoured country at all. And that is when the infantry, we were taken out of the half tracks and put into Kangaroos.
Why was the Reichswald so unpleasant? What was it about it that...
Well, the weather was horrible. I mean, it was midwinter, and if you... It was a very, very bad winter indeed. I mean, it was extremely cold winter. I mean, a horrible winter. And this was still the tail end of the winter. And so the ground was awful. It was extremely cold, nasty conditions. It was full of the most awful forests and dripping trees. And as you've just said yourselves, the Germans had their back to their... I mean, this was their last stand before the Rhine, really, and they were in their own territory. I mean, the Reichswald was part of Germany, so they were fighting for their own territory.
What sort of tactics did they employ in the forest? Did they have static, strongly fortified defences, or did they use defence in depth with mobile reserves?
Well, I don't know if they had many mobile reserves, but they certainly used strong points. They had a defensive system there, the Schlieffen Line, so they had a certain amount of dug fortifications. I mean, it wasn't quite like the Siegfried Line further down, but it was a properly planned and sighted defence position. So, I mean, they really had to be, you know, pushed out of every bit of it.
Did you find that you tended to get channeled and canalised when moving through that sort of ground?
Yes, I mean, certainly you did. I mean, you couldn't just go swanning through some of these very, very long, thick woods. The infantry divisions, of course, tended to do the actual woods, and the armour tried to do in the gaps in between, but there weren't all that number of gaps.
And the gaps weren't that wide. But presumably it's in the Green Jacket or the 60th tradition to go skirmishing through woods.
Well, that, of course, is perfectly true, but, I mean, yes, you're quite right there. But, I mean, to the wider commander, he wouldn't take notice of that. He'd say, we'll put the 3rd Division through there. And they used a new technique called pepper potting. Well, pepper potting phrase is used for several things. Skirmishing, you can sometimes call pepper potting. But this pepper potting was losing your light anti-aircraft guns, Bofors, firing over the heads of your troops and exploding in the trees in front of you. I remember Mike Carver saying rather cynically, the progress of the 3rd Division seems to be almost directly related to the production of ammunition from the British ammunition factories. But there was a terrific lot of ammunition. And the armour tended to go. I mean, the armour really took their life in their hands. And they went from bound to bound. And there was a frightful lot got bogged down. I mean, the bogging of anything, tanks probably didn't, but half-tracks certainly would, and scout cars certainly would, and soft-skin vehicles would. I mean, the mud was awful. It was a very, very unpleasant place. And eventually, combined pressure from the north and General Simpson's 9th Army